and welcome to Religion in the News. I'm Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next 30 minutes, we'll be featuring articles from Religion News Service, from the Washington Post, from the Deseret News, and more. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired, and unless otherwise noted, all articles are read as printed. Don't forget that podcasts of this and other episodes of Religion in the News are available on our website. Just visit ncreadingservice.org. We'll begin this week on Religion in the News with an article that is kind of out there. Yes, I'm prone to jokes like that. I apologize. The article is entitled, "For Atheists, the Idea of Aliens Seems Real. Religious People Doubt It." The subheadline, "A New Study Finds That Atheists Think There Just Might Be Aliens Out There. Evangelicals Are Not So Sure." And this article was written on August 23rd on Religion News Service and written by Bob Smetana. Tom Flynn does not believe in God. He's less willing to say the same about aliens. "Given the evidence we have now, I think it's more likely that a dispassionate observer would conclude that intelligent life elsewhere is possible," said Flynn, a science fiction writer and editor of the humanist magazine Free Inquiry. Now, that's a very different thing from saying little green men are visiting Earth in UFOs. A 2021 study from Pew Research found that atheists and other non-religious Americans are more likely than their religious neighbors to be open to the idea that intelligent aliens exist. 85% of atheists and agnostics say their best guess is that intelligent life does exist beyond Earth. So do 80% of unaffiliated Americans, also known as nuns. By contrast, only 51% of Protestants and 40% of white evangelicals are open to the possibility of intelligent aliens. So are about two-thirds of Catholics and mainline Protestants, and about half, 55% of black Protestants. Overall, 57% of Christians in the United States say their best guess is that there is intelligent life on other planets. Pew's survey was prompted by the release of a report from the Office of National Intelligence, detailing a number of unidentified aerial phenomena and the difficulties involved in explaining those phenomena. Curiously, the question of UFOs and their meaning scrambles the way religious and non-religious Americans line up. Catholics, 61%, and those who claim no particular religious identity, 59%, are most likely to say UFOs are definitely or probably a sign of alien intelligence. Atheists, 31%, and white evangelicals, 35%, are least likely. Overall, about 65% of Americans say their best guess is that intelligent life exists on other planets. About half, 51%, say that UFOs reported by military personnel are definitely or probably signs of intelligent alien life. The survey also found that religious practice affects how Americans see aliens. Those who pray often and regularly attend services are skeptical about the existence of alien life. Those who don't pray or attend services are not. Flynn chalks up the difference between the two views to how people see the origins of the universe. "Many conventionally religious people in the United States," he said, "believe in a single act of creation, where God created life once and Jesus came to earth to redeem people once. Because the idea of intelligent life on other planets undermines a core religious belief, religious people seem to be less open to the idea of life elsewhere. Non-religious people don't have that constraint," Flynn said. Unlike non-religious people, religious believers typically also feel that human life is unique and beloved by a higher power, said best-selling sci-fi author John Scalzi. "If you believe that, then the idea that there might be other intelligent life out there might feel weird, because we wouldn't be then unique and special and beloved, we would just be another creation," Scalzi, who is agnostic, told Religion News Service in an email. "If one is not particularly religious or has a connection to a higher power, then this is not part of one's thinking, and therefore entertaining the idea of intelligent life elsewhere isn't as much of an issue," he said. Author Sasha Sagan, who identifies as secular, said there is a difference between being open to the possibility of intelligent life in the universe and being certain that such life exists. She is not ready to embrace the latter without more evidence. Sagan, daughter of the famed astronomer Carl Sagan, also said that the idea that life on Earth might have happened by accident and that there may not be other intelligent life out there can add meaning to human life as something precious. "There's something about that that makes it feels like it matters quite a lot to be in this world," she said. With no evidence of alien life in the universe, however, both sides are operating purely on belief, according to David Weintraub, professor of astronomy at Vanderbilt University. While scientists have discovered planets that appear to be Earth-like, there is no evidence, at least for now, that life exists there. He suspects that could change in the future, pointing to a new generation of space telescopes that will allow astronomers to examine the atmospheres of different planets. I can easily imagine that within 100 years we will have studied and surveyed tens of thousands or even millions of planets around other stars, he said. Then we'll have some solid numerical evidence for or against the existence of extraterrestrial life. But right now, we have nothing. Discovering alien life would have profound implications, he said. Having real knowledge that we are not alone in the universe, I honestly can't think of a more philosophically, theologically profound discovery, he said. It would have enormous effects on our understanding of our place in the universe. For some, the sheer enormity of the universe makes the possibility of alien life more likely than not. There are so many stars and so many galaxies, said Jake Kerr, a science fiction author and screenwriter from Dallas, that the probability of life existing elsewhere makes sense. The idea that humans are alone in such a vast universe does not, said Kerr, who identifies as an atheist. Kerr said the vastness of the universe really came home to him after attending the Launchpad Astronomy Workshop, which gives science fiction writers the chance to learn more about modern astronomy. During the workshop, Kerr and other participants climbed a mountain for an unobstructed view of the night sky. Seeing the Milky Way in that setting brought him to tears, he said. You see the Milky Way in all its undiminished glory, and it's spectacular, said Kerr. Sagan said that she'd be thrilled to hear other forms of intelligent life in the universe. For one thing, she said, humans have some problems that we could use a hand with, and the idea of meeting an alien, she said, would be amazing. It almost brings me to tears thinking about it, she said. My first thought would just be how I wish that my father were here if that were to happen, to share in that wonder. Our next article on religion in the news this week comes from the Washington Post, the August 19th edition, and this article is entitled Philadelphia Becomes Latest Archdiocese to Reject Religious Exemptions for Vaccine Mandates. This article is by Marissa Iotti of the Washington Post. The Archdiocese of Philadelphia is the latest district of the Catholic Church to reject religious exemptions to coronavirus vaccination mandates, reflecting a stark divide among the church's hierarchy over immunization requirements. Church leaders in the nation's sixth-largest city urged priests Wednesday not to help parishioners evade the shots, which the Vatican has deemed morally acceptable. Individuals may wish to pursue an exemption from vaccination based on their own reasons of conscience, Kenneth Gavin, a spokesman for the Philadelphia Archdiocese, said in a statement. In such cases, the burden to support such a request is not one for the local church or its clergy to validate. Philadelphia joins at least five other dioceses that have given their priests similar guidance, including San Diego, New York, Los Angeles, Honolulu, and Camden, New Jersey. Their stance sharply contrasts with the position of other bishops and Catholic organizations that have supported those seeking exemptions for reasons of conscience. Those divergent positions at the highest level of the church in the United States exemplify Catholics' divided attitudes toward vaccination. They and other people of faith, most of whose beliefs emphasize the dignity of human life, are grappling with how that conviction applies to vaccines developed during a pandemic that has killed more than 4.3 million people worldwide. In a vaccine promotion campaign, Pope Francis on Wednesday called receiving a vaccine an act of love. Vaccination is a simple but profound way of promoting the common good and caring for each other, especially the most vulnerable, he wrote. He added that he hoped everyone may contribute their own small grain of sand, their own small gesture of love. Catholic dioceses and groups, including bishops in Colorado and South Dakota, that are objecting to vaccine requirements have emphasized their belief that immunization is not a moral obligation and must be voluntary. The Philadelphia-based National Catholic Bioethics Center stressed the use of fetal cell lines in testing the vaccines, the novelty of COVID-19, and the importance of each person's individual discernment. A Catholic may judge it wrong to receive certain vaccines for a variety of reasons consistent with these teachings, and there is no authoritative church teaching universally obliging Catholics to receive any vaccine, the center wrote in a template letter for requesting a religious exemption. A growing number of governments and businesses have implemented vaccine requirements in recent weeks as a coronavirus surge prompted by the uber-contagious Delta variant upends the pandemic. Most of those mandates have an exemption for sincerely held religious beliefs. Each Catholic bishop makes policy for his own jurisdiction. Some dioceses, including El Paso and Lexington, Kentucky, have announced vaccine requirements for their own employees. Mark J. Seitz, the bishop of El Paso, wrote that his decision was guided by Jesus Christ's focus on the love of neighbor. Bishop John Stowe of Lexington said vaccination was urgent. The healthcare system is now overwhelmed by a crisis caused primarily by those who refuse to protect themselves and others by getting vaccinated, Stowe said in a statement about his diocese's mandate. This is unacceptable, and our diocese now joins those employers who have already made this basic commitment to the common good a requirement. Despite disagreement on mandates, most Catholics report having received their shots. Hispanic Catholics' coronavirus vaccine acceptance stood at 80% in June, while 79% of white Catholics said they had also been immunized, according to a survey conducted by the Public Religion Research Institute. The number of Catholics rejecting vaccination for religious reasons is unknown, but some Catholics' hesitancy to get immunized has centered on the use of fetal cell lines in developing or testing the three federally approved vaccines. The lines are basically reproductions of fetal cells from decades-old abortions. Acts the Catholic Church teaches are gravely immoral. None of the vaccines include fetal tissue. Other objections to vaccination are based on demonstrably false claims. Before he was hospitalized with COVID-19 last week, Cardinal Raymond L. Burke alleged that some believe there should be a microchip placed under the skin of every person so that at any moment he or she can be controlled by the state regarding health and about other matters which we can only imagine. The Vatican's doctrinal arm has said vaccination is morally acceptable, but added that it is not a moral obligation and should be voluntary. The Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith added that those who decline vaccinations must do everything they can to avoid transmitting the virus. Bishop Kevin Rhodes of Indiana, chairman of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops Committee on Doctrine, previously told the Washington Post his committee had not attempted to mandate vaccination, but had urged it as an act of charity toward other members of our community. It's an act of love of neighbor. Our next article on religion in the news this week will take up the majority of the rest of the time of the program today, and it comes from the September issue of Deseret Magazine, and this article is entitled "The Looming Threats to Religious Colleges." The subheadline, "As Support for Gay Rights Grows, Religious Schools of All Shapes and Sizes Face Pressure to Change Policies on Sexuality, Gender, and Same-Sex Marriage." And this article is by Kelsey Dallas of the Deseret News. As a student at Calvin University in Grand Rapids, Michigan, Claire Murashima was told to ask big, scary questions and trust that God would be present in the answer. She had that lesson in mind last fall when she took the largest leap of faith of her life. Murashima had just been elected student body president of the small religious school and wanted to use her power to lead meaningful conversations about gay rights. She wrote an editorial for the student paper publicly coming out as bisexual and then brought it to school leaders before it was published to prepare them for what she was going to do. "I didn't want to go behind their backs in any way," she said. What Murashima did want was the answer to a big, scary question. She wanted to know if Calvin could become a campus that served the needs of gay students while also celebrating religious values. "I wasn't pushing for a specific political outcome," she said. "I wanted LGBTQ people to know my school was a place for them." As support for gay rights grows across the country, religious schools of all shapes and sizes face the same question, and it's not just students seeking a response. Policymakers, donors, professors, and other stakeholders are all wondering whether faith-based colleges and universities can better care for members of the LGBTQ community without sacrificing the religion-related policies that help drive their success. So far, few institutions have fully engaged with the debate, but soon it will be impossible to avoid. Democrat-led policy proposals in Congress and a lawsuit filed this spring by dozens of former Christian college students are putting pressure on religious colleges and universities from the outside, as students like Murashima pour pressure on them from within. In the near future, religious schools will have to take a leap of faith and trust God to help them find a path forward. "The whole world should be rooting for them to find their way," said Shirley V. Hoekstra, president of the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities, which serves more than 150 North American schools. "Christian higher education produces committed, compassionate, convicted citizens who want to engage deeply in this world, not in spite of their faith, but because of their faith," she said. Religious colleges once dominated the American academic landscape, but over time they've lost ground to larger secular institutions that don't have to navigate faith-related restraints. If you look at the history of higher education, the clear trend has been to start off as religiously affiliated, and after some time, decades or centuries, look just like secular universities. "We have to keep reminding ourselves of our mission," said Brigham Young University President Kevin Worthen to the Deseret News in 2019. Today, there are still hundreds of religious colleges and universities in the United States, but most are quite small. However, when it comes to responding to the needs of underserved communities, the schools punch above their weight, Hoekstra said. Faith-based schools serve and graduate a diverse population of students, including DACA recipients, incarcerated students, low-income students, adult learners, and first-generation students, she said. Partly because of the unique makeup of their student bodies, many faith-based schools would be forced to close if they lost access to federal aid. Daniel Bennett, who leads the political science department at John Brown University, a Christian school in Siloam Springs, Arkansas, estimates that around 95% of faith-based schools depend on federal funding to stay open. For these institutions, alumni and denominational support is also crucial. School administrators must try to balance the needs and interests of students and faculty with the demands of these often much more conservative benefactors, said John Hawthorne, who recently retired from Spring Arbor University, a Free Methodist school in southern Michigan. If you try to appease those conservative voices, it's going to put you in a place that makes it hard to hold your students and faculty, he said. Although religious colleges come in many forms, nearly all share the goal of helping students grow spiritually and academically at the same time. School leaders integrate faith with learning, whether in the campus chapel or a lecture hall. There's this idea that we can prepare students to interact with the world through the lens of and totally consistent with their faith. There's no compartmentalization, Bennett said. As someone who grew up religious but attended public elementary and secondary schools, Bennett understands the pain that can come from feeling like you have to check your faith at the classroom door. To him and other advocates of faith-based higher education, the invitation to see religious values as an academic asset is a miracle of sorts. Going to a Christian school for college was a breath of fresh air for me, Bennett said. However, the religious freedom offered by faith-based colleges comes with some notable strings attached. Students must often agree to abide by a moral code, which typically includes prohibitions on drinking, smoking, and premarital sex. In recent years, these codes of conduct and related policies on sexuality and marriage have landed many schools in hot water. Former students, accrediting bodies, and policymakers, among others, have questioned whether faith-based schools are using religion as an excuse to be cruel. The Christ-centered focus and gospel lens used by our Christian institutions is becoming increasingly countercultural, Hoekstra said. But she and other advocates of faith-based higher education object to the notion that religious schools are singling out LGBTQ students for mistreatment. Our goal is that all students be treated with respect, dignity, and love, BYU officials said earlier this year. The school's Office of Student Success and Inclusion manages individual outreach and social events for students who are part of the LGBTQ community, while LGBTQ students sit on many department committees and councils across campus. These efforts and others will continue as we work to fulfill President Worthen's vision that every student feel fully a part of the BYU community, noted BYU Student Life Vice President Julie Franklin. Under federal law, faith-based colleges can request a religious exemption to non-discrimination rules. If granted, they can sidestep certain legal protections for the LGBTQ community and others and continue enforcing their most controversial policies like bans on same-sex marriage. If successful, the current lawsuit brought by former students at religious schools would force the Department of Education to stop offering these exemptions. Faith-based colleges are also facing pressure from Democrats in Congress, many of whom believe LGBTQ rights protections outweigh religious freedom law. Any policy change, whether it originates in Congress or an executive order, would be challenged in court, where the hundreds of judges appointed by former President Donald Trump are unlikely to rule against religious schools, Bennett said. However, those judges won't always dominate the legal system. In the near future, religious schools could be forced to make some very difficult decisions about LGBTQ rights. That reckoning is coming. It's just a matter of when, Bennett said. Hoekstra hopes policymakers and judges will continue to respect the strong religious freedom protections offered by the Constitution. Religious schools subscribe to a number of sincerely held biblical convictions, and the right of our institutions to teach and instill those convictions in the next generation of believers is protected by the First Amendment, she said. Growing up, Murashima didn't know it was possible to be both Christian and queer. No one fit that description in her family or church, and so when she began questioning her own sexuality, she felt confused and alone. I didn't tell people because I was too ashamed, she said. That pain and fear was on her mind as she prepared to come out to her campus community. She felt like publishing the editorial on her sexuality was an act of love for her younger self. My biggest desire was increasing representation, said Murashima, who identifies as bisexual and queer. I just wanted to show students at Calvin and parents of students and kids growing up in the Christian Reformed Church that they're not alone if they're LGBTQ. At other religious schools, a growing group of people are working toward similar goals. Students are increasingly speaking up in support of gay rights and calling on school leaders to do the same. Nationwide, half of white evangelicals and Latter-day Saints and more than three-quarters of white mainline Protestants and Catholics who were younger than 30 in 2017 support same-sex marriage, according to PRRI. Importantly, many would say they hold this position because of their faith, not in spite of it. The most vocal affirming allies or members of the LGBTQ community on my campus identify as Christians. They see supporting gay rights as a way to further realize their Christian identity, Bennett said. Hawthorne came to a similar conclusion while leading a recent class discussion about the tension between the Catholic Church and its gay members. Among his students, opposition to LGBTQ rights was the exception, not the rule. There were only a couple students who asked, "Why aren't we saying gay marriage is a sin?" The rest of them were saying, "How can you treat gay people like this?" he said. Growing support for gay rights on Christian campuses is giving some LGBTQ students the courage to come out. As they do, many of these young people are asking school officials for help, making the gay community on campus feel less anxious and alone. Murashima said that when she came out, she wasn't trying to scandalize her campus or burn it down with demands for political or theological change. Instead, she wanted to use her pre-existing relationships with school officials to ensure that hard but necessary conversations about what it was like to be gay at Calvin would finally take place. "I felt like they were on my team and that I was on their team," she said. "Some of them told me these are conversations that needed to be started. Thank you for speaking up." Other Christian college students advocate for a less measured approach. Those involved in the lawsuit on school funding, for example, demand nothing less than immediate policy change. Both types of students can make life difficult for leaders at Christian schools, Hawthorne said. To more conservative alumni and donors that also demand officials' attention, even starting a conversation about religious support for LGBTQ rights feels like a dangerous act. The mindset of students has changed dramatically. The mindset of the alumni and donors to Christian colleges has not, he said. In America today, faith-based schools are far from the only religious institution facing an uncertain future. Church pews are emptying. Nonprofit budgets are shrinking. Religiously affiliated foster care agencies are losing government support. In response, some faith groups are choosing to make a radical change. For example, the largest Christian adoption agency in the country announced earlier this year that it would begin serving same-sex couples who want to foster or adopt. They got a lot of flack from conservative Christians for that, Bennett said. But the agency's position was that if they didn't update their policy, then they'd have to close. They said it was best for children if they continued to foster, Bennett added. The Council for Christian Colleges and Universities made a similarly proactive move in 2019 when it called for passage of a piece of federal LGBTQ rights legislation called the Fairness for All Act. Like the better-known Equality Act, the bill would protect gay and transgender Americans from discrimination in most areas of public life, but it would also ensure religious institutions, including schools, could operate according to their beliefs. The Fairness for All Act is both principled and pragmatic. It is principled in providing a clear and demonstrable way for people of faith to love our neighbor in the civic context, and pragmatic in that the bill makes explicit many religious protections that are important to a rich and vibrant civil society, Hoekstra said. The council's embrace of the bill, like the adoption agency's policy change, is controversial within the conservative Christian world. Some faith-based schools would choose closure over showing any level of support for LGBTQ rights, Bennett said. He and other advocates of faith-based education hope it won't come to that. There's still time for religious schools to regain their footing if they'll start looking for solutions instead of dwelling on their fears, Hawthorne said. I think these things are possible, but not when one is operating out of such a negative view of the future, he said. Murashima is among those hoping religious colleges and universities will be around for years to come. Being at a faith-based school made it hard for her to come out, she said, but it also made it hard for her to abandon her faith, which for her was a good thing. I would have not had the confidence to come out publicly and be okay with my faith and still be so strong with my faith if it wasn't for my Calvin education, said Murashima, who graduated in May. She added, I'm glad that it was a given. It was a given that all my mentors, professors, administrators, and friends would all have the same desire to help me keep my faith. We'll wrap up this week on religion in the news with an article from the Associated Press dated August 21st. Silenced by COVID, mariachi mass returns to Tucson Cathedral. This article is by Giovanna Dell'Orto of the AP, Dateline Tucson, Arizona. We will have to edit this for time. A blast of festive trumpet flourishes and guitar on bass breaks the solemn hush of Mass on a torrid August desert morning. Decked out in gold-embroidered suits, nine musicians pick, strum, and trumpet the entrance hymn under tall stained glass windows. After more than a year of silence due to the pandemic, mariachis are back playing Sunday services at Tucson's St. Augustine Cathedral, where the colorful and sonorous tradition dates back a half century and fuses Roman Catholicism with Mexican-American pride. For the hundreds of worshipers gathered in the Spanish Colonial Church and other congregations across the Southwest, the unique sound of mariachi liturgy is more than just another version of choir. It evokes a borderlands identity where spirituality and folk music have blended for centuries. Syncretism is the reality of this land, the ambos reality, said the Reverend Alan Valencia, the cathedral's rector, who grew up attending mariachi mass in Ambos Nogales, or both Nogales, as locals refer to the two cities of the same name, straddling the U.S.-Mexican border about 60 miles to the south. And that's what we see at these mariachi masses, he added. Faith and culture come together and grow. Mariachi forms the soundtrack to daily life here in the Borderlands, accompanying everything from backyard barbecues and quinceañera coming-of-age parties to weddings and funerals. Yet while mariachi is a popular genre at its core, musicians and parishioners alike say its emotional interplay between trumpet, violin, guitar, vihuela, and guitarrón is a natural complement to the holy rites of Mass. The Mass itself is a reminder that you don't just have mariachis you tip at a tableside in a cantina, said Alberto Rangel, who has been playing at the cathedral since he was nine and now leads the ensemble his father founded, Mariachi Tapatio. It is a representation of my culture. Worshipper Leilani Gomez echoed that sentiment, saying, "They bring to Mass culture and art together with the presence of God. They make you feel the presence of God." The first canon of mariachi mass was composed in Cuernavaca, Mexico, after the Vatican encouraged the incorporation of regional musical traditions into services in the 1960s. Called the Misa Panamericana, or Pan-American Mass, it features a specific order of instrumental arrangements, sung prayers, and hymns, according to Dan Shee, director and curator of the Smithsonian Folkways recordings. At the time in the United States, the Chicano civil rights movement was blossoming, and mariachi musicians morphed from folksy troubadours to cultural heroes, symbols of Mexican identity heightened here because of multiculturalism, Sheehy added. Mainstays of mariachi mass include the joyful Pescador de Hombres, or Fisher of Men, the Spanish-speaking faithful's equivalent to Amazing Grace for its popularity and ubiquity, and a thrilling rendition of Franz Schubert's 19th-century classic Ave Maria. During performances of the latter at the cathedral, Rangel turns to face a painting of the Virgin of Guadalupe, patroness of Mexico and the Americas, and intones the Latin version of the lyrics. "The prayer aspect of it is what I'm respecting by singing it in Latin," he said. On a recent Sunday, the show kept going on even after Mass was over, with musicians serenading worshippers on the palm-lined patio outside the cathedral. Victor Soltero, who has been worshiping at the cathedral for some 50 years, also rejoiced at their return. "It makes you happy," Soltero said, "and what better way to come over and honor the good Lord than having some beautiful music that picks you up?" We've run out of time for this week on Religion and the News. We appreciate you tuning in. I'm Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service, and the content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. We'll talk to you next time on Religion and the News from the North Carolina Reading Service.